You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, nationwide participation in high school sports dropped last year. The decline was sharpest for low-income students. We'll find out why rising costs and time commitments are keeping many kids out of the game. Now, college affordability is a hot-button issue for many parents and students. A new report finds that the University of Wisconsin-Madison is one of the most affordable large public universities in the country. However, the same report finds that while UW-Madison is doing well when it comes to the cost of tuition, it's admitting fewer low-income students compared to other comparable schools. Our next guest joins us to talk about the report and what it could say about the UW system. Rich Kramer is a reporter for WPR based in Eau Claire. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, tell us, give us some background on this report, Rich. Who's doing it? What are they doing here?
So this was a report put out by the Institute for Higher Education Policy. It's a national kind of a think tank policy watchdog group. And every year they take a look at these types of things like costs at universities in general. They offer suggestions for state and local governments and the federal government as well. The title of this report was called Opportunity Lost, Net Price and Equity at Public Flagship Institutions. Now, a flagship institution, it's a term we hear a lot about, but you don't really hear it defined. What they were looking at in this report were the most exclusive institutions, generally large, exclusive, hard to get into public universities. And in Wisconsin, it's no doubt that the flagship is University of Wisconsin-Madison. So they started crunching numbers, and they looked at five different profiles of students with different family incomes, whether they work, whether they are single, whether they have children. And they found that, in general, nationwide, only around 6 out of 50 flagship institutions met what they called an affordability benchmark for students who are not from wealthy families.
And where did UW-Madison stack up compared to all these other flagship schools around the country?
Madison was one of the 6. In fact, they have a little graph here that shows UW-Madison is in the top 4. And what that means is we're talking about unmet needs. So after financial aid, after whatever grants, everything is said and done, they're worried about, or they're looking into what the student has to pay out of pocket after everything else is said and done. So at UW-Madison, they found that with all the different grant programs that the school is offering, the unmet need is essentially zero, and actually less than that. They found that some of these programs can give the students some money in their pockets after all the bills are paid.
So that's the upside, but the report also finds that UW-Madison admits fewer low-income students than many of these comparable schools. How do they measure that?
Well, they look at the percentage of students receiving that are enrolled, students receiving Pell Grants. And the Pell Grant is a federal program that offers need-based financial assistance for students from low-income families or students that don't make a lot of money themselves. And they found that UW-Madison had around 12% of their student body were Pell Grant recipients. Nationwide, that number is 30. And I looked into some statistics for Wisconsin, just the whole state. We're talking private schools and UW campuses. And it's around just under 30% of students as of the 2016-2017 school year were receiving Pell Grants. So that's a marked difference between what's happening in the state as a whole and at UW-Madison.
And so this report, Rich, uses that number of or percentage of Pell Grant recipients as kind of a proxy, a rough guideline to how many lower-income students might be at an institution like UW-Madison?
Yeah, absolutely.
Talking to Rich Kramer, reporter for WPR based in Eau Claire, looking at a new national report that looks at college affordability at public flagship universities around the country. UW-Madison coming out among the more affordable there, but also the number of low-income students. UW-Madison not coming out at the top of that list. Rich, you got some reactions from the UW system, especially to that that last part. What kind of things do they say about efforts to bring in maybe lower-income students?
I spoke with UW-Madison's director of student financial aid, and that's his name is Derek Kindle. And what he told me first off is that UW-Madison is what they call a need-blind institution. That means that they have no idea about a student's ability to pay when they're determining who to admit. And he said because of that, they're not aware of those figures until after the students are enrolled and they get information from the federal government about this, the financial aid packages that their students are getting. So he said, it's hard for them to know ahead of time, but he said also that it might mean that they have to do a better job around the state in terms of recruiting students from more high schools that have a lot of low income students or students from low income families. So they're definitely working on that. And he also says that the campus is working on that. They're trying to leverage connections with the University of Wisconsin Extension, which was kind of its own thing, but was merged into UW-Madison as part of the restructuring that happened in 2017. And so though that has county offices around the state and rural parts of the state, it's a trusted place, and they have the teams of people trying to reach out and find more students that would boost that Pell Grant recipient score a little bit.
So the idea in that kind of effort, and I guess part of the idea in this report as well, is the idea that, okay, is it the mission of these public flagship universities to make sure that at least a decent number of lower income students have access to it? Is that kind of the underlying philosophy there?
Yeah, definitely. And it also kind of it kills two birds with one stone from a university's perspective, because we're also, I just did a story last week about the number of college age students declining in general. It's projected to decline in the Midwest 15 to 25%. So a lot of universities, we've heard the UW, we've heard Marquette University, they're all thinking about how do we get more people in the door that we might not have targeted in the past, because the education pipeline is starting to slow. And so recruiting in areas where they don't normally will help with increasing the number to make it more representative, the Pell Grant recipient number, but also it gets them more students and more money.
And these are issues that I imagine you mentioned UW-Madison and Marquette. I'm guessing these are probably issues that'll face a lot of UW system schools.
Every campus. I mean, it's really stark when you look at, there was just a big drop reported in the fertility rate when the Great Recession hit, 2007, 2008 time frame. And we're starting to see that on the horizon, how that trickles down to the number of college-age students graduating from high school.
Rich, thanks a lot for sharing this report with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Rich Kramer, reporter for WPR based in Eau Claire. Coming up, Wisconsin's fall color report is out. We learn how to use it to find the best foliage in the state. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the state is out with its fall color report. We find out where the best leaves are going to turn up this year. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about extreme runners.
There was recently an elite race at the Pettit National Ice Center in Milwaukee. Competitors ran for 6 days straight. Yeah, you heard me. These racers ran around an indoor track for 6 days straight. WPR's Corrine Hess put on her running shoes for an afternoon to interview some of the competitors on the racetrack to find out what keeps them going.
Okay, I got so many hours times 60 minutes. Then what kind of pace do I need to keep to get to where I want to go? It gets mentally more difficult that way. Now, it's kind of embarrassing for me because I'm a retired engineer.
Jim Feist of Cedarburg has been running for 5 days straight. He has 17 hours to go and a goal of 250 miles. With a mop of gray and white hair and a full beard, he looks younger than his 77 years.
I've done 6 day one time before. I have a poor memory.
So far, he's gone around the track more than 800 times. That's gotten him just under 223 miles. It's a numbers game, and most of the 70 runners at the Pettit Center in Milwaukee are playing it. They're here from around the world to compete in the second edition of 6 Days in the Dome. Runners from as far as Sweden, Mongolia, and Japan came to Milwaukee to participate. Race director Steve Durbin says when registration opened a year ago for this race, it filled in a day. Durbin's race management company has hosted dozens of ultra-running events for the last 15 years, including the famed Barkley Fall Classic in Tennessee. Durbin says the races have gotten more intense over the years because of social media.
Everybody's on Facebook now. So when you first start, hey, I run a 5K, and everybody's like, that's awesome, yay, way to go. Hey, I ran a half, oh, good, good. And hey, I ran my first marathon, that's great. And then you start thinking, what about a 50-miler? And what about a 100-miler?
Feist was the only runner from Wisconsin to participate in the event. In the 1970s, he gained what he describes as a whole bunch of weight. So he found an old pair of red Keds and ran around the block.
I thought I was going to die. Well, one thing led to another. You know, marathons, and a friend of mine, you know, did this kind of thing. And so I said, boy, that sounds interesting.
3 weeks from now, Feist plans to run a 24-hour race in Cleveland.
I think there's some bragging points to this. If we all admit it, you know, I did a 6-day. Most non-runners really have a hard time figuring it out.
I'm so exhausted.
Sally Libanati from Florida signed up for the 6-day race because some friends were doing it. She also grew up in Little Chute, so she knew her family would be close enough to cheer her on in Milwaukee. Libanati is no stranger to distance running. Before this, her longest race was 200 miles in 55 hours. She's headed to Virginia in a few weeks for a 100-mile race. Nearing the end of the 6-day race, she was tired. But she was enjoying herself because of the camaraderie.
It's really nice that everyone helps everyone else out. And it's really nice to get to talk one-on-one with all the other runners, because at some point you're going to be next to one of them and, you know, learn where they're from and their families and what brings them here.
You may be wondering, how do these runners eat and sleep? It varies. Some competitors limit themselves to 10-minute catnaps. Others, like Feist, sleep for a few hours a night. As for food, anything goes. Some runners crave fried chicken or dairy. Feist had a taste for something else.
My wife showed up today with our granddaughters, and she brought me something they don't have here, and it's watermelon. I love watermelon.
Feist and the others finally stopped running on Saturday afternoon. Feist finished in 46th place, and he beat his goal with nearly 256 miles.
WPR's Corrine Hess is based in Milwaukee and brought us that story on 6 Days in the Dome. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, we still have 14 more days of summer, but not long after that, a lot of Wisconsin will already be in peak leaf. You know the drill. Rich, vibrant fall foliage, ruby reds, pumpkin oranges, mustard yellows. Thanks to producer Tim Peterson for the poetical imagery there. And the state has a pretty sophisticated system for predicting and monitoring the changes in each county called the Fall Color Report. The report just went online recently. Tourism Secretary-designee Sarah Meany joins us now with more on the Fall Color Report. Secretary Meany, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm so happy to be talking about fall and the beautiful colors in Wisconsin.
Now, before we get to those colors and the website where we can find them, how big a deal is leaf tourism here in the state?
Oh, well, you know, one of the things that people definitely know about our four seasons is that with it comes the incredible bounty of color that comes along with fall. So while we all love to get outside four seasons, fall is definitely one of the biggest feasts for the eyes in Wisconsin and in the upper Midwest.
Now tell us about the Fall Color Report website. There's a lot of information there.
Oh, absolutely. So this is something that we have found to be one of the most popular uses of the TravelWisconsin.com website overall. The Fall Color Report itself is really important because we know fall is a really short season in Wisconsin. It happens really quickly. And what people want to be able to do is tap into where they can see the best colors, how far away it might be for them, what kind of planning they can do in advance when we're trying to predict things that are kind of unpredictable. Mother Nature has taught us that over the years, right? But what we're able to do is we have 100 fall color reporters, actual people throughout the state who give us updates every day for all 72 counties around the state. And so what that means is people can stay up to date on when the colors are about to peak, when they're hitting their end, and when people can expect within days of, you know, the best time to visit.
Now, those reporters are giving us the latest, the current info, but the site also has predictions, the best guess of when things are going to be are going to peak. Most of the state, that's we're talking about October there. How do we make that kind of prediction?
Well, it is tough. You know, I am certainly not an arborist or forestry specialist, but, you know, the nature of fall color has everything to do with water and sugar content in the leaves and amount of sunshine and temperature fluctuation. And so all those things are pretty tough to predict, but there are people much smarter than I am on those categories that help us make some of those predictions in order to say, all right, so things are starting to get a touch of yellow or a touch of, you know, pink over here. We anticipate that in the next coming days, it'll start to really, really bloom in terms of color. So the best we can do, of course, is give everyone an up-to-date, virtually live view into what's going on a specific day so people can guess that if they can get there in a few days, they're still going to see some of the best sites and vistas.
And I saw on the website there are some teaser videos. I watched the one for Tim's Hill, giving us a taste of what things look like at peak color. It's awful tempting to try to plan around those videos.
Right. It's like a feast for the eyes, right? So it's a little bit like watching a cooking show, and you just can't wait to make that meal for yourself. The same thing with some of our videos. They're as tempting as they are because the beauty really is that extreme. So some of the best places to go see true, you know, large vistas, the one that you just mentioned, of course, is really great. But, you know, we have a lot of wonderful hikes where people can see that. We have so many beautiful state parks all over the state. And again, travelwisconsin.com is a great place to start planning your trip if what you do is start with the fall color report and try to figure out where else you want to stop along the way, whether it's stop for a great local meal or one of the local breweries or maybe a roadside attraction along the way.
Now, I know the fall color report online has changed a lot over the years since I first started looking at it. I seem to remember maybe all caps text or just, you know, just text over the years, and it gets fancier. What are some of the newest wrinkles in the works?
I'm really pleased to report that our friends at the Department of Natural Resources also like it so much and are so happy with it that they've brought it to the front page of their website as well. I think we're all in it together, making sure that wherever people are looking for that information, they can find the best and most up-to-date. So, but before the interactive map itself was created, there were weekly reports that were sent out by the department that would note the progression of colors throughout the state. And again, we use the eyes of volunteer fall color reporters at the time. And then in 2003, there was an interactive report that you see today. So the report itself gets better and better as technology continues to evolve and get more sophisticated. But the core info is the same. Basically, the goal is to let people know when and where they can find peak fall color in Wisconsin, and frankly, give visitors from all over the country and all over the world a reason to choose Wisconsin as a fall travel destination, instead of maybe some of the other areas around the country. So it really is easier to navigate the pages than it used to be, and it's a cleaner appearance, easier to find the information. It also tells you and integrates temperature conditions and weather forecasts, so it can give you a great idea and reduce the number of excuses to not going out and see the colors. And you can also connect where you're going to other activities and events. So you'll see icons, kind of activity icons associated with each of those destinations that connect to nearby events, things to do, places to stay, dining options. So it's really a fully integrated resource into that map based on fall color reporting.
We mentioned Tim's Hill already. Any other favorite spots for you or the staff there?
Well, so I've always really loved going to Holy Hill near Hubertus. The higher you can get, the more of the color you can see. So up at the top of that peak, of course, is a gorgeous shrine. But at the same time, there's also, you know, towers you can climb at a lot of different state parks. Certainly, if you're willing to take on, you know, quite a few steps, you'll be paid off with an incredible view.
And what makes looking at the changing leaves in Wisconsin such a great experience in your view?
Well, I mean, I don't know about you, but the beauty of nature is so inspiring. I think it lets us step outside of the hustle and bustle every day and just remark at what a beautiful world we have and a beautiful state we have. I think it helps us ground ourselves in some more simplistic ways to spend our time. I always like the fall to get my family outside and go for a hike and get fresh air and spend time together and have conversations about things that are real and not just things that are on a screen. So again, it connects us to each other and it connects us to, you know, this gorgeous state that we call home. And I think that probably makes us better neighbors to each other as well.
Secretary Meany, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Sarah Meany, the Wisconsin Tourism Secretary Designee. We talked to her about the state's fall color report for this year and how, where, and when to find the best foliage around Wisconsin in the month and a half to come. Coming up, we'll find out how the changing nature of high school sports is leading to rising costs and less participation, especially from lower-income students. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guest look at the long-term prospects for the paper industry here in Wisconsin. A lot of plants closed over the years. Others have adapted today's economy. Find out more tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, high school sports have traditionally given kids a chance to have fun, stay active, and compete during the academic year. These days, though, they may be taking on a more professional feel. Things like traveling summer leagues and personal trainers are getting more common for top athletes and teams. As that raises the costs and time commitment needed to keep up, more lower-income students are taking a pass on sports altogether. Derek Thompson is a staff writer for The Atlantic. His recent piece is called "Meritocracy is Killing High School Sports." Derek, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Well, before we get into the income breakdown on this, what are we seeing overall when it comes to the number of kids sticking with athletics into high school?
So in the 2018-2019 school year, the number of kids that were participating in high school sports declined for the first number in three decades. That was at least the headline that I saw on ESPN as I was beginning to research some of the elements of this article. But it turns out that 30 years ago, the high school population itself was shrinking, and that's because of a sort of short-term fall-off in births after the baby boom. So this past year, I have calculated, is the only period on record where high school sports participation declined even as school attendance increased. We've just never seen anything like this before. And so in this piece, I basically dug into exactly why this is happening.
And you say this isn't a universal. There is a family income difference here. What do we see?
Yeah, absolutely. So what you basically see is that starting at the youth sports level, kids from higher income families are now much, much more likely to be playing team sports than children from low income families. Here is the statistic. Kids from homes earning more than $100,000 are now twice as likely to play a team sport at least once a day as kids from families earning less than $25,000. And what that tells me is that a lot of these richer parents not only are more active in their children's lives or spending more on child enrichment, but also what they're doing is they're putting their children in these pay-to-play youth sports leagues, these travel teams, where they'll essentially spend hundreds, thousands of dollars and lots of time moving these kids from county to county, putting them on teams where they're playing other typically middle-class or high-income kids from, a county or a state away. And as a result, they're essentially pulling these kids out of the local rec leagues. As a result, these local rec leagues that are supposed to be somewhat communitarian, they're withering on the vine. They're becoming desiccated. And low-income kids are pulling back from them, deciding to stay home because the middle and higher-income kids aren't playing with those teams anyway. And as a result, this system by which the higher classes are trying to, you know, cherish their children, love their children, give their children a leg up and make them more successful at these youth sport, they're essentially desiccating the local rec league.
What does that mean then for lower income kids who may not have that athletic opportunity, who don't end up playing, say, in high school?
Well, there are at least two categories I think we should be worried about. The first category to be worried about is all of this data, all this research that seems to indicate that exercise and playing sports, especially when you're a kid, is really, really important for cognitive development. So if low-income kids are cut out from that, that's something to be very thoughtful about, especially since this is a really sensitive period in the creation and in these children's cognitive development years. The second thing is college, and that's that, you know, athletic recruiting now is arguably the biggest form of affirmative action in American higher education. Division I and Division II schools spend $3 billion on student-athlete scholarships. So if low-income kids are less likely to be prepared to get a slice of that $3 billion, then not only do you have sort of the cognitive impairment of being cut off from youth sports when they were young, you also have the fact that they are cut off from this opportunity to get sports scholarships from D1 and D2 colleges when they're older teenagers.
I think a lot of times the public reputation of those athletic scholarships, if people look at it positively, is, hey, this is great. This gives kids from poorer families a different way to get into college. How does it actually play out?
Right. That is exactly what I thought was the situation. I thought that the vast majority of these student-athlete scholarships were going toward kids who, you know, were coming from a low-income background, who say, you know, neither their parents went to school. That's not the case at all. In 2010, just 28% of D1 basketball players were from first-generation college students, meaning they came probably from low-income families. You know, that percentage is actually falling rather quickly. So today, fewer than 1 in 7 students receiving athletic scholarships across all D1 sports are coming from families where neither parent went to college. That is not a picture where most of this money is going to kids from low-income families. It's a picture where a lot of this student-athlete money is going to middle-income and even high-income students. One researcher, Tom Ferry, that I spoke to from the Aspen Institute, called this the slow-motion gentrification of college sports, that essentially you had this pie of money that we might have, you know, decades ago hoped would mostly go to low-income kids who needed the money to go to college, and now it's mostly going to the upper middle class.
Derek Thompson is with us, staff writer at The Atlantic. His recent piece is called Meritocracy is Killing High School Sports. He looks at the numbers of kids playing high school sports going down, especially for low-income kids. I don't know if you wrote the headline, Derek, but meritocracy. Talk about that as a concept as it plays into all of this.
Sure. I didn't write the headline at The Atlantic. We have editors who work in the headlines, but I'm happy to defend the headline here live. So I think that, you know, there is a definition of meritocracy, elusive and maybe even delusional definition of meritocracy that basically says that outcomes equal deservedness, that people who get student scholarships or people who succeed in the labor force are inherently deserving. But the way that meritocracy seems to work, I would argue, is that higher income parents essentially can afford better opportunities for their children, can afford better teachers and better coaches, can afford more shots on net throughout life. And as a result, high-income students tend to succeed in a way that lower-income students don't. I think you see exactly that dynamic playing out in the youth sports and high school sports level, that essentially you have high-income parents who, through often sheer love of their children, are paying for their children to play with richer, more talented kids on special, pay-to-play travel leagues, which is setting them up for a more successful high school experience, which itself is setting them up to become student athletes at the D1 and D2 levels. So that which appears to be a kind of a pure meritocracy is basically a phenomenon of class domination.
Now, you say, as you say, this is parents trying to be good parents here. Is there a bad guy in the story, or did we just sort of evolve this weird system by accident?
Yeah, that's a good question. I tend in my writing to not identify, or at least to not try to identify, bad guy individuals. I do think that overall what's happening at the youth sports level is bad. And I do think that a lot of high-income parents who think that they are acting through sheer love of their individual child are in fact doing bad. They are hurting their communities. They're hurting the lower and middle class members of their communities. And making it harder for those children to have an equal opportunity. So I think that they are that the consequence of their behavior is negative. But I also want to make clear that I understand that the actions that they're taking are being taken out of love for their kids.
You've talked to some different experts on this. Are people offering different models, different ways that this could work better and get those low-income kids into these sports that keep them active and maybe give them that opportunity?
Yeah, there are a couple examples. Unsurprisingly, they tend to come out of Scandinavia. I believe, if I recall, Norway has actually been rather innovative in terms of making it impossible for travel league pay-to-play teams to even evolve. They've also done something where they've reduced the number of championships that exist at the youth sports level, which makes it sort of foolhardy in the first place to try to scramble to get your kid on the most successful team. We might consider that to be kind of participation trophy culture, but it seems to actually have a really positive outcomes for the sort of overall coaching of middle and lower income kids. I mean, Norway absolutely dominated at the Winter Olympics recently. I think they had one of the most successful Olympics in world history very recently. So clearly what Norway is doing seems to be working at the international level, and they have a much more sort of participatory approach to youth sports.
Derek Thompson is with us, staff writer at The Atlantic. We're talking to him about an income divide and who's playing high school sports. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something you've seen during your own time in school, maybe your athletic career, or with your kids? Have you ever chosen not to play a sport, or your kid has done so because it took too much extra time, too much money? If you're a parent, have you noticed more pressure today for kids to specialize in one sport? If you're in coaching yourself at a club or high school level, what do you see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, about how high school sports are getting more competitive and expensive and maybe keeping more low-income students from playing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something you've seen? Is the cost of youth sports just getting too high in your opinion? If you're an athlete yourself, a parent thereof, or a coach, love to hear your perspective on all this. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. David is with us in Gurnee, Illinois. David, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. So I have two quick comments and then a question. I'm in the 100,000 plus, and I have two girls, and they don't play sports. I guess I was wondering if you had ever really looked at male versus female. And then my real, I guess, comment is I watch college basketball, college football, like most people do. I don't see the athletes that are getting these scholarships at Division I schools that fit, I guess, what your guest is saying in terms of upper middle class getting these scholarships, because I don't see that.
David, thanks for the call. You looked at the numbers, Derek, for overall scholarships, and it does seem to be weighted one way or another, right?
Are we talking about gender? Are we talking about income here?
For the income first, yeah. Then we'll get into the gender part.
Sure. I'll take the questions or comments sort of as they came. First of all, I couldn't see a major difference between male and female participation in high school sports. What seems to be the case, though, is that a lot of different sports are in decline. Tackle football is in the steepest decline in terms of participation among high school sports. That's not a crazy mystery. A lot of that has to do with fears about head trauma, but also basketball, baseball, golf, all those are losing players too. One stat that actually is relevant for girls is that the number of girls playing high school basketball has actually fallen to its lowest level since the early 1990s, I found, and that's not a story that head injuries alone can explain. On the issue of D1 and D2 athletes and their income, look, you can't see income. Income isn't a thing you can literally see. What you can see are the statistics, and the statistics are that in 2010, just 28% of D1 basketball players were first-generation college students. A first-generation college student is a pretty good proxy for a low-income family because education and income tends to be pretty highly correlated in the United States. So the fact that that number is low and getting lower tells me that the teams that D1 basketball school, that the D1 schools are putting forth on the basketball court are increasingly populated by children from middle class families.
David, thanks for the call. We'll go to Barb now in Lake Hocum. Barb, hi.
Hi. I'm a school counselor and I'm very familiar with sports and the benefit of it. Sports have become our at-risk program because we're no longer funded for at-risk. But it provides an opportunity to keep kids in school. It gives them motivation and also gives them mentorship through the coaching staff. So we're losing a really valuable component when our students in lower income groups aren't able to participate.
Interesting, Barb. Thanks for the call. Derek, what do you think?
Yeah, this thing I heard from over and over again. I mean, again, I think that the benefits of playing youth sports or high school sports, they are cognitive, they are educational, and then they're also social. And so when you take away the opportunity to play youth sports, even for someone who doesn't necessarily want to go on to, play seriously at the varsity level or the college level, you're still taking away the cognitive benefit. You're still taking away the social linkage, and you're also taking away this opportunity for mentorship. So again, I think it can seem like a bit of a siloed story, like, oh, youth sports leagues are in decline, or, fewer kids are playing high school sports. How is that possibly a socioeconomic phenomenon? Well, it is for precisely these reasons. This is a scientific and social benefit to kids. And when you take it away, it hurts both the psychology and the social element of their upbringing.
Barb, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Derek, I wanted to get into another issue you brought up in your piece in The Atlantic about the expectation that kids would specialize in a sport. They had to devote more and more of their time and attention to that one sport.
Right. So there are two things to talk about here. First, it is clearly a phenomenon that parents are more interested in having their children specialize in a particular sport that they seem to show some aptitude for. There's a frenzy around early specialization. And this is probably true not only for sports, but also for a lot of other things. Now, specialization does two things. First, it probably increases the likelihood of injury and burnout. There was a 2015 paper from Harvard that concluded that essentially what they define as specialization, which is at least 1 year of intensive training in a single sport that means quitting other activities, that makes it more likely that these young people are either going to hurt themselves or that they'll actually ironically get bored of or sick of the sport and then pull out of it because of emotional exhaustion. Actually, there was one coach who likened the overwork of young athletes in basketball to an epidemic at the semi-professional level. But another thing that happens is that if you have specialization, it means that there are fewer kids in high school who are on multiple high school teams. Like if a teenager plays three sports, then they count as three distinct participants in each of those sports, you know, football and then basketball and then baseball. If you have them pull out of two of those sports and focus exclusively on football, it means that you have smaller high school teams for those other teams. And that can be bad for other players who didn't specialize. So I think from a variety of perspectives, early specialization, while it seems like a really attractive strategy to sort of maximize success for your student, can lead to injury, burnout, and also, you know, sort of hurt the ego and the joy that other kids have from that student's second and third most favorite sports.
Talking to Derek Thompson, staff writer for The Atlantic, about problems in youth sports. They're expensive, they require more time and specialization, it seems like, and it's keeping more low-income students from playing. He wrote about this in a piece in The Atlantic. Back to your calls now. Gene is with us in Richland Center. Gene, hi. Gene's gone. All right. Derek, talk about the competitiveness of youth sports now. It seems like, and I've heard this from other people over the years, it seems like there's not a place for the casual student athlete who wants to have fun, get some exercise, not that concerned with being on a super winning team.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly describe my experience in high school. I played JV soccer, and I was not particularly competitive. I was not particularly talented, but I still got to hang out with my friends and run around, and it was a positive experience. I do think that, you know, one good way to think about this issue is flowing from the statistic that D1 and D2 colleges annually distribute $3 billion in student-athlete scholarships. 30 years ago, that number was 300 million. So the size of student-athlete scholarships has increased tenfold in 30 years. Now, what effect is that going to have? Well, if parents recognize that athletic success at the, you know, at the teenage level, at the high school level, is going to be really important for burnishing college applications, then richer parents are going to have the opportunity to spend a lot of money on enrichment programs to make sure that their children are the best set up to get some of that $3 billion pie for student-athlete scholarships. They're going to turn sports into just another pre-professional program with rising costs and hyper-specialization and what economists sometimes call opportunity hoarding among the privileged. That is essentially to say, I want my kid to be on an expensive travel team. I'm going to pay a lot of money to make sure that happens, even if the community rec league suffers as a result. And I think essentially that attaching sports to something that as prized as college outcomes has essentially forced American-style meritocracy to strangle the roots of youth sports and high school sports. And frankly, I think that it would be better for kids in a variety of ways if parents just chilled out about sports. And in order for that to happen, colleges would have to probably do the same.
And Derek, in our last 30 seconds, can we get there from here when it comes to the attention colleges are putting on this?
Yeah, this gets to maybe a whole other bag of worms, but I would like to see colleges spend a lot less on student-athlete scholarships. I would like them to spend a lot more on giving scholarships to students from low-income families or from students from families who, you know, don't have a parent who graduated from college. If today one of the biggest forms of affirmative action in American higher education is athletic recruiting, I think that's a problem, because higher education, I don't think, should be about athletic recruitment. I think it should be about education, and it should be about, you know, equality and undoing sort of the history of inequality that exists before these students enter college. So I would love, frankly, to see a lot of schools in this country divert the billions that they are spending on student athletes.
Thanks to Derek Thompson from The Atlantic. His recent piece is titled "Meritocracy is Killing High School Sports." Tomorrow on Central Time, state attorneys general around the country are taking antitrust action against Google. We'll find out what's at stake in that lawsuit. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow after 7, for years, it was the family vehicle of choice and the deployment system for young athletes. But now is the minivan on the decline. Kate and her guests look at the latest trends in family automobiles. That's tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to an emotion scientist about the idea of emotional intelligence and why he says we all need to understand our feelings for our mental and even our physical health. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.